Okay, so Habakkuk 1, verses 1 to 11. The prophecy that Habakkuk the prophet received. How long, Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrongdoing? Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore the law is paralysed and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed. For I am going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I am raising up the Babylonians, that ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are a feared and dreaded people. They are a law to themselves and promote their own honour. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swooping to devour. They all come intent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. They mock kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. By building earthen ramps, they capture them. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on. Guilty people, whose strength is their God.
Thank you. It's been 30 years since this film came out, but I wonder if anyone's seen the film Grand Canyon. It came out in 1991, and it didn't... it sort of caused a bit of a ripple, but it wasn't hugely successful, but it had an amazing cast, and it was one of those films that was designed to ask some very big questions. And in this film, it has a sort of a range of different characters, and the scenes move from different life to different life, all set in Los Angeles. And Kevin Kline is an immigration lawyer at this big sort of megacorp firm, and he's driving home after a basketball game in Los Angeles, and he takes a wrong turn off the freeway and ends up in a very dangerous part of town by mistake. It's riven with drug gangs and all kinds of crime. And to make matters worse, absolutely typical, his car breaks down in this neighbourhood. And then as he's waiting, he doesn't have a mobile phone, obviously, so he calls for a mechanic to come, and he goes back to his car, sits in his car, and as he's waiting, sure enough, a gang arrives in their BMW and basically start hassling him. And you can just see him sitting there, sort of terrified, and completely fish out of water, completely out of his comfort zone. But in the nick of time, a mechanic's truck arrives, and this is driven by a man called Simon, an African-American, who's played by Danny Glover. And at the moment when he's just sort of finding out what's going on in the car, the guys in the BMW get out of the car and they start having words with Simon. And you don't quite know what's going to happen. Well, Simon takes the leader of the gang to one side and has a word with him. And basically just says, look, everything is supposed to be different than it is. In other words, you're not supposed to be giving this guy a hassle. He's not supposed to be in this neighbourhood. I'm not supposed to be talking to you. It's not supposed to be like this. But of course, it is what it is. And the only way to get respect in the sort of urban jungle is the gun. And it's hard to fool the logic. Simon says, look, I know that while you've got the gun, then you are in control. And so this gang leader just says, well, I won't do the accent, but he says, so you showing me respect? And Simon says, yes. But he thinks for a moment, he says, but basically, you ain't got the gun, we ain't having this conversation. In other words, it's because he's got the gun that basically he is in control of the situation. Without that, life would carry on, they wouldn't be having a conversation, they wouldn't be in this situation. In other words, in this crazy messed up world, might is right. And if you've got the gun, or if you've got the weapons of mass destruction, or you've got the totalitarian regime, or whatever it is, you are calling the shots. You can invade a neighbouring country, if you like. And one of the themes of the film is basically the inability of law enforcement to do anything about it. You've got all these sort of ordinary people who are sort of messed up, but doing the best they can, and trying to sort of navigate this crazy world and life. But law enforcement is nowhere to be seen at the moment when you need them. And one of the sort of the motifs of the film is just seeing these police helicopters just flying high above the city with their sort of searchlights, maybe, but they're too remote. They're not going to do anything. Basically, you just have to survive. And the film ends with this disparate group of people going on a day trip to the Grand Canyon. And they are overawed by the natural world, and it's amazing. You see them on the edge, and the camera pans back, and it's just mind-blowing. And then it ends. There's a sense in which their little lives are put into perspective by this epic, ancient formation, but it's not really a satisfying answer. It's just saying this is the way it is. Might is right. I think it's a fascinating film, and it's a brilliant analysis of so many aspects that have gone wrong in modern society, and it hasn't actually dated very much as a result. But there's something huge missing, and that is God. But of course, that's absolutely right, isn't it? Because God is missing from most people's big picture. The best they can do is to go to the Grand Canyon and get awed. And then what? And you might think, well, if only God was in place, then this film wouldn't be so despairing. But hang on a minute, is that actually true? Wouldn't the picture just actually perversely be more difficult to cope with? If all these things are going on and you do believe in God. Because you see, nothing would actually change. These things would be going on, and you see the injustices of the world carrying on, and you think, but there's a God? How do we square that with the reality of a God on the throne? It just doesn't add up. It's actually easier to live with a universe that doesn't make a lot of sense and go to the Grand Canyon and be awed in a sort of liver-shivery, amazing way, but it doesn't actually have answers. You can kind of live with that far more easily than a God who claims to be good and just and loving and all this stuff's going on. You see, actually, this is the kind of question I think Habakkuk is wrestling with. He's racked with doubts, but they're actually very surprising doubts. Because you see, to his mind, God is the problem. God is the problem. And I reckon actually, hopefully by the end of today and certainly tomorrow, we might see that these doubts that Habakkuk has are the kinds of doubts we ought to have, ironically. What do I mean by this doubt? Well, the first point I want to make is that this is a doubt that is the direct result of his beliefs. It's because he believes certain things that he is doubting and questioning and confused. Just follow with me. Now, just to get a sense of what is stressing him out, we need to do a little bit of ancient history. And by all accounts, Habakkuk is working through the turbulent years after the death of King Josiah. He'd been a good egg on the whole. We're about 100 years or so after the Assyrians, who were basically the big bullies on the block, the Assyrians have destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel. The lost tribes of Israel were destroyed by the Assyrians, never to be reformed, never to be found again. They've gone. And the Judah, the southern kingdom, is a tiny rump. You know, it's less than 20% of the whole. That's all that's left. That's all that Judah is. And Jerusalem is this great capital of this tiny little sort of bump, basically, at the bottom, the southern kingdom. And the Assyrians are still looming large, 100 years on. And they've even surrounded Jerusalem. But, as is the way of things, empires come, empires go, and the Assyrians are beginning to decline, and others are jostling for position. It's always the way. The remotest sign of weakness, there'll be others trying to see what they can take advantage of. Now, Josiah had done a grand job of bringing the people back to God's covenant so that they were trying to live as God wanted them to live in the land. And Josiah had removed the Assyrian idols, these gods that had been imported into the temple in Jerusalem, and he had got rid of that lot and called people back to God, just as the covenant, in short, the book of Deuteronomy, called to happen. But it wasn't just the Assyrians on the fringes. There's another threat, and it's an old, familiar threat: Egypt. And Josiah himself actually was killed by an Egyptian archer at the Battle of Megiddo, otherwise known as Armageddon. And after a brief interlude with Josiah's second son on the throne, the Pharaoh installs Josiah's firstborn, a chap called Jehoiakim. Now, he is a very different kettle of fish. He's ruthless, he's cruel, but above all, he is faithless. And as so often with despotic regimes down the centuries, he sets the tone for the whole nation. And Habakkuk describes himself speaking into this situation. In verse 1, he calls himself the prophet. And most likely he was one of a whole score of, range of temple full-timers who were professional prophets. It was a kind of job description, if you like. They were in the temple to teach, to give guidance, to get people studying the Bible, anyone who would come. And basically, he would meet people and mentor them and all of this. So in a way, he was a Bible teacher. And he could see firsthand, both from what he was experiencing, but also reports coming in from people he was engaged with on a daily basis. He could see what was going on in the country. And he's heartbroken. So look in verse 3. There's injustice and wrongdoing. There's destruction and violence. There's strife and conflict. I don't know whether you've got to know folks from Ukraine. Ukraine is a country I've grown to love a lot in the last probably 8 or 9 years. I've been a number of times. And what's been going on in the last 6 months is heartbreaking, because some of the streets that I've seen on TV being blown up, I've walked down. And so suddenly these words like violence and destruction suddenly come very close to home when it's places you know. And I guess for Habakkuk, he was hearing stories from individuals firsthand. And basically it seems as if it's bound to be like that. There's nothing you can do about it. Verse 4, you see, the law is paralyzed. And justice never prevails. I mean, basically, the Today program in Jerusalem each morning was just gruesome. A bit like it is now. I've given up Radio 4 completely, and I just have Radio 3 now because I can't cope with Radio 4. But basically, it's just non-stop. And the worst thing about it is, who suffers the most? Well, those who try to do the right thing. Have a look at verse 4. The wicked hem in the righteous so that justice is perverted. That would be bad enough. But Habakkuk knew his Bible. You see, these were the very things going on that were condemned in the law. He knew what God has said in Deuteronomy and in the covenant. He knew what the terms of agreement were for living in the land, the terms and conditions. You may not have heard of him, but a chap called Lord Hewitt was the Chief Justice in the 20 years leading up to the Second World War in this country. And in a 1924 case, he famously said this, and they're words that you will no doubt recognize. He said, "It is not merely of some importance, but is of fundamental importance, that justice should not only be done, but should manifestly and undoubtedly be seen to be done. In other words, everybody needs to know that this is what's going on, that this is how justice works, and you can trust it. Well, under King Jehoiakim, the opposite was true. Injustice was not only being done, but injustice was manifestly and undoubtedly being seen to be done. You can get away with it. As long as you know the right people and have the right connections, might is right. And so Habakkuk cries out in confusion. He cries out to the only one he's got to turn to in a crisis. God. You see that in verse 2? How long, O Lord, must I call for help? But you don't listen. How long must I cry to you, but you don't save? Why do you make me look at injustice? You've made me care about these things. Don't you care? You see, Habakkuk's problem is precisely the fact that he believes in God. If he didn't believe in God, this wouldn't be a problem. It's just the way of the world. The sort of, you know, dog eat dog, the nature is red in tooth and claw. It's just how it is. But no, he believes in God. He knows his standards. He knows he's holy. And it seems that the rampant injustice, that people getting away with stuff, left, right and centre, seems to put a lie to the fact that God exists and that this is his people. Why doesn't God do anything? He seems deaf, he seems blind, he seems passive. Now, while we're in the mood for quoting law enforcement officers, a chap called Sir Robert Anderson was the Assistant Commissioner in the Metropolitan Police in 1888, so slightly before our time. But he was a Christian and a good friend of Spurgeon's. And he said this, and I guess being a chief of police means that you actually encounter some of the worst of this stuff, but he said this: a silent heaven is the greatest mystery of our existence. A silent heaven, the greatest mystery of our existence. But then it's as if a worse thought crosses Habakkuk's mind. You see, if God is not deaf, blind, and passive, does that mean that something even more chilling is true? Verse 3, do you tolerate wrong? Is it actually okay with you too? Tolerance is today's great virtue, isn't it? And I think sometimes Christians go overboard in rubbishing it. I'm very grateful for tolerance. I'm very grateful to live in a tolerant society. There are a lot of things that make life much more livable because of it. It's something to champion. And I, for one, am very grateful that people tolerate me on the whole, although you've only got to do it for 24 hours. And I want to be tolerant of everyone and anyone. But you see, it's one thing to be tolerant of an individual person. It's a very different matter to tolerate a crime. Could a victim of crime ever be tolerant of it? They might resign to it, but they wouldn't be tolerant of it, as if it didn't matter, as if it could happen any number of times, unless their lives and sort of sense of reality have been so seared and destroyed, as if they're sort of numbed to it. But that's not tolerating it. So the question is, you know, if that's true on a human level, how much more is it with God? Does he shrug and say, oh well, you win some, you lose some? So Habakkuk reasonably asks, like the psalmist, how long? But notice, and this is a shock, He's not primarily concerned about himself. He's not impatient for God to save him. He's impatient for God to judge. Which is a shocker, isn't it? He wants God to judge his own people, Judah. Things have got that bad. He can't see any alternative. So he's saying to God in his prayers, do you honestly mean for me to tolerate this for much longer? Because you seem to be tolerating it, God. You see, it's precisely because he believes in God that he has these questions. And the awful thing is that Habakkuk's questions haven't gone out of date. There's a global cry for justice. We lived in East Africa for a number of years. I was teaching in a seminary. And one of the first things that I really had to learn was how much in the West we take for granted the recourse to justice. We assume, and it hits the news, doesn't it, if people don't get justice. But we assume, okay, well, there'll be a way through somehow. It might take a long time. But basically, I have friends, we have students who've been, say, refugees from Congo. They knew that it was just not going to happen. They were never going to get justice in this world for what they'd suffered. And they were right. And basically, that is normal human experience, isn't it? A third century Christian writer called Cyprian was writing a number of letters to a friend, Donatus. And he's writing to him and he says this: this seems a cheerful world when I view it from this fair garden under the shadow of these vines. But if I climbed some great mountain and looked out over the wide lands, you know very well what I would see. Brigands on the high road, pirates on the seas, in the amphitheatres, men murdered to please applauding crowds, under all roofs, misery and selfishness. It really is a bad world, Donatus, an incredibly bad world. That could have been written yesterday. I suggest that if we honestly claim to believe in God, then that should force us to share Habakkuk's doubts. We should be crying out, how long, Lord, before you judge? I think that's a legitimate question. More than that, I think it's an important question. Because if we're not asking it, it either means we don't believe that God is good and sovereign, or it means we don't really see what's going on. Or it means we don't really believe God is what he says he is. So how does God respond? Well, what we get in the rest of the section is what I called a defence, a beyond belief. That should be defence, not doubt. A defence beyond belief. Look at verse 5. Look at the nations and watch. So this is God giving his response. Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed. I mean, this is sort of, you know, it's familiar stuff. If you know the Bible, you know that God sometimes says, you know, get ready, fasten the seatbelts. This is going to be a ride. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. In fact, you are being told, I'm telling you this, and you're not going to believe it. And you can almost hear Habakkuk thinking, okay, Lord, this better be good. I am raising up the Babylonians. What? You've got to be kidding. You see, when Habakkuk was alive, they were old news. In fact, not just old news, they were ancient news. The Babylonian Empire, first time round, was 1,000 years before. 1,000 years. They, you know, basically, most people didn't know about that unless they were sort of very good historians. But most people wouldn't have known. Babylon, what is that? It's just a sort of backwater in the Assyrian Empire. What are you doing? So the surprise is, who are those guys? You know, it'd be a bit like announcing at Prime Minister's Question Time in the House of Commons that there was a real threat of invasion from Normandy. 1,000 years on. What? The Normans? You've got to be kidding. No wonder the Lord says you're not going to believe it. But actually, that's not the thing you're not going to believe. Yes, the Babylonians are going to be back. The second Babylonian Empire is going to be much more impressive than the first. It's quite extraordinary, you know, a millennium between their two flourishings. And you can see all kinds of stuff from this period in the British Museum. Go and spend a day there and following some of this stuff out. You can see exactly the period we're talking about. And what God says about the Babylonians makes you think, what? So look at verse 6. They're cold-hearted imperialists. They're ruthless and impetuous. They seize dwelling places not their own. I mentioned the British Museum. Well, there's a proof of what empires do. Look at verse 8. They're well-equipped. Horses swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves. Verse 9. They're determined. They come from afar, bent on violence. Literally, God says, they are coming for violence. Verse 9. Their numbers are overwhelming. Their hordes advance like the desert wind and gather prisoners like the sand. Verse 10, they are unstoppable. They deride kings, scoff at rulers, they laugh at all fortified cities that build earthen ramps and capture them. It's unbelievable. But God himself said we'd struggle to believe it. So what's going on? Because actually, has God resigned to the might is right game as well? Because basically the Babylonians defeat all before them by being the mightiest. Well, this little series on Habakkuk is entitled Ask an Honest Question, Get an Honest Answer. And Habakkuk asks some pretty honest questions, and God gives him some extraordinary answers. And nobody said that you would like the honest answers. Now, you might be thinking this raises a whole host of problems. I mean, the big one is obvious. You know, what is a holy and righteous God doing using a ruthless and sinful people like Babylon? How can you use that group to bring about justice? Two wrongs don't make a right. Well, that is a big question, and we'll come back to it. But for now, I want to just close with two key principles that we learn from this. But we have to suspend judgment on the rest of it, because we can't deal with all the aspects of this. But just, these are two principles to hold in mind while we suspend our judgment on God. And the first point is this, that he is the global God of justice. He's actually committed to it. He sees, he's not blind to the rampant injustice. No, he sees. He's not deaf to the pleas of Habakkuk and many others for it to stop. He's not deaf to that. He hears it. And he's not passive when it comes to doing something about it. We don't want him to be deaf and blind and passive. We want him to act, don't you think? And the crucial thing is that he does say he will put a stop to what's going on. But the confusing thing is why he sometimes waits so long. Now, that is a huge problem. And I don't really know the answer to that most of the time. When we were in Uganda, we had some dear friends who, an American family who'd been working in East Africa all their lives. And there was a little boy in an orphanage that they'd encountered who basically had a hole in his heart. And I think he was at this point about one. And there was no way he was ever going to get that operation to solve that. And medics here will explain how that works. I don't really understand. You like put a cork in it or something? I don't know. Basically, this kid was going to die. And so they thought, how do we do something about this? Well, the only way actually is to adopt him so that we can get him back to the States. And even then, it's touch and go as to whether or not we'll be able to have this operation on our insurance, because we didn't insure for him when we came out, blah, 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 blah. Big saga over many weeks and weeks as they had to get the processes for him to be adopted and all of that stuff. And then that was only the first battle fought. Then they had to work out what to do and how to get him over there and so on. Anyway, in the end, it all came together. And I remember this, the father, Brent, said to me, because he taught in our college as well, and he said, one of the lessons that's hardest to learn in Christian life is that God is never late, but he's rarely early. And that's really annoying. I just wish God would turn up a bit earlier sometimes, because that would just, you know, just ease the sort of the butterflies, if not the stress. Why didn't God stop the appalling sexual, physical, emotional abuses in Christian-run orphanages in Ireland, in this country, in North America? Why didn't he stop that? Why didn't he stop the constant traffic of East European girls who become sex slaves in London's West End? Why didn't he stop that? Why didn't Hitler get stopped before the Holocaust even began? Why didn't Stalin get stopped in his tracks before murdering more people than anybody else during that period? And so on and so forth. Why? Does God tolerate this? Paul wrote to the Roman Christians with this strong conviction. He said this: God presented Jesus as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood. And he did this to demonstrate his justice. In other words, if you doubt God's justice, he's saying, Paul is saying, look at the cross and then ask again. To demonstrate his justice, because in his forbearance, he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. So it's not that they didn't matter, it's not that he hadn't noticed. He's saying, yes, I've seen it all, and I'm aware they are unpunished until this point. And he did it to demonstrate his justice at the present time, so as to be just and the one who justifies. In other words, to show that he is holy and has mercy. That's the genius of the cross, and it does both. You see, unpunished crime does not remain unpunished. It is seen, the cries are heard, and God is not passive about it. It's just that his timing is on a completely different plane from ours. You see, the one thing that is not in doubt is God's commitment to justice. And any confidence we can have in God's ultimate justice is firmly rooted in what he's done in Jesus. One of the things that was very clear to me in our years in East Africa was to recognize why the justice of God is good news. We sometimes think, you know, the justice of God is bad news, and that basically the good news is Jesus dying to save us. That's a distortion. Actually, it is integral to the gospel that Jesus is both judge and saviour. So I prefer to talk not about the day of judgment, because that sort of has connotations, but to talk about the day of justice. And who doesn't want that? Which brings us to the second point. You see, there's a global warning of justice. Paul set out on his first missionary journey. He visited the town of Pisidian Antioch, not to be confused with the Antioch in Syria. So this is Antioch in the middle of Turkey. And he preached a potted Bible overview there. You can read it in Acts. And what is his conclusion in Acts 13? Well, guess what? He introduces Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5. He quotes this passage. And he says, this is Paul in Antioch, he says this: take care that what the prophets have said does not happen to you. He understands that the promise of justice, you see, is still relevant, it's still coming, and it's good news. It is good news. I remember sitting in our college library late one evening. Everybody else had gone home, and there was a guy called Emmanuel who had been a bank manager in Kisangani, the second city of Congo. Very sort of well-educated, sophisticated guy. He told me that, you know, he had three daughters, I think, what did he say, three cars, but only one of which worked. He lived quite a comfortable life, but basically when everything blew up, when the West stops backing Mobutu and Congo collapsed basically and has never recovered, it's still in chaos, he had to flee on foot with his wife and daughters. They walked hundreds of miles over many, many weeks and ended up in Uganda. And he had seen members of his family macheted. And he was explaining to me, you know, how he was and so on. And he sat there in the library, and basically African men don't cry, you just don't see that. And the tears were just quietly streaming down his cheeks. And he said, I could not be a Christian if it was not for the justice of God. God is not blind, but he's not blind to the fact that we ourselves have guilt. Okay, we haven't necessarily done what the Babylonians have done, I hope. But we are accountable. You know, he's not going to draw a line here and say, right, you know, judge everything out there, but no, you can't do that. And even Babylon will face it. You see, look at verse 7. They're a law to themselves and they promote their own honour. They've got no time for God. And promoting your own honour is the heart of sin. Verse 11, they're guilty men whose strength is their God, so they worship the things that make them mighty, because might is right. God knows what they're like, and he knows that they're guilty. And in the end, human might is not right. That God will bring justice. But perhaps you find that something scary to believe. Well, if so, the cross is the ultimate refuge from that fear. This is the extraordinary thing about what makes the good news good. It is good whichever way you look at it. The cross, you see, not only demonstrates God's commitment to justice so as to be just and the one who justifies, but in Romans 5, just a few verses later, Paul says, he did this to demonstrate his love. He is committed to mercy. And the cross is the place he does it. So it's on that sure footing, I can say, take care and have hope. But at the same time, because this is proved, who God is and his character, that he is committed to justice, then we must be crying out in our prayers, how much longer, Lord? Or do we not care?